I'm going to ask you now to turn to Matthew's Gospel. And chapter 27. In our church Bibles, these red Bibles, page 705. As most of you know, on Sunday mornings we've been reading through Matthew's Gospel. We've been looking at Jesus and his disciples. There were lots of people who said they were Jesus' disciples. They said Jesus was their teacher, their master. But out of all those people, Jesus chose just 12 who would travel with him wherever he went. They were the inner circle. They were his closest friends. He allowed them to share his work. He explained things to them that he didn't explain to anyone else. He gave them authority to do miracles in his name. He allowed those men to see his glory in a way that no one else saw it. It was those men who first realized the wonderful truth that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. Those men were sure that Jesus is the King, the Lord. They were convinced that he was the one whom God had promised to send. He was the man who was going to put everything right that had gone wrong in the world. He was the man who was going to destroy all the evil that was in the world. He was the man who was going to reign as King forever for God. These 12 disciples were chosen to receive amazing, wonderful privileges. And we've traced through the story of Jesus' dealings with them. Well, Jesus tells his disciples that he's going up to Jerusalem, the capital city of Israel. And so the disciples travel there with him. They march behind Jesus into Jerusalem. But his enemies are waiting for him. Jerusalem is run by a clique of powerful religious leaders, headed up by a group of priests. And these folk hate Jesus. And they're determined to have him put to death. Their plan is simple. They're going to wait for a moment when Jesus is alone, or at least when he's not got crowds around him. They're going to have him arrested. Then they'll put him on trial quickly, overnight, before anyone really knows what's happening. They'll condemn him to death. They'll hand him over to the Roman government. Officially, they distance themselves from the Roman government. But unofficially, they've got a very cozy relationship with the Romans. And the Romans will execute him. Business done, no loose ends. That's the plan. And it works. It works because one of Jesus' disciples turns traitor. Judas Iscariot agrees to become a spy for the priests. He promises to tip them off where and when they can safely arrest Jesus. We read last week the story of how Jesus was arrested. It happened on Passover night. Jesus ate the Passover meal with his disciples. But during the meal, Judas Iscariot slipped away. He was off to the high priests to give them the information they'd been waiting for. When the meal was over, Jesus and the other 11 disciples went out. Very late at night now. They went out to a garden outside the city on the Mount of Olives. Jesus wanted to go there to pray. And once again, Jesus warned the disciples what was going to happen to him. And he said, I know what you're going to do. He said, you're all going to turn away from me. Of course, the disciples said, no. They said, no, we'd never do that. Most definite of all was Simon Peter. He says, everyone else may turn against you. I never will. And Jesus has to say to him, look, Simon, before this night is over, you'll disown me not just once, not just twice, you'll disown me three times. And Simon Peter just doesn't believe it. Jesus tells Simon and the others to pray that they won't be tempted, that they'll be shielded from temptation. But they just go off to sleep. They don't see the need. They can't believe that they will feel that temptation. And then there in the garden, they hear the sound of men coming towards them, trampling through the bushes, armoured men, men with swords. Judas has guided the men to this place. And Judas himself goes up to Jesus and kisses him. That's the signal that Judas has agreed with the soldiers to help them identify Jesus. And then the soldiers close in around Jesus. For a moment, the disciples, led by Simon Peter, try to make a fight of it. Simon whips out his sword. But Jesus says, no. This is what God my Father has planned. This is what the scriptures of the Old Testament say must happen. This is what I have chosen. And then the disciples scatter and they run. Right up to this moment, the disciples have refused to believe that Jesus really is going to be arrested, that Jesus really is going to suffer and die. But now at last they know that Jesus has meant it all along, and they can't cope with that. They would fight and lay down their lives to help Jesus set himself up as king. But they can't cope with the idea of Jesus being arrested, of Jesus being treated like a criminal, of Jesus being humiliated and crucified. That goes right against everything they've ever expected. They've believed all along that Jesus is just going to lead them to victories, to triumph, to success. They've believed that Jesus is going to set himself up as king there in Jerusalem and sweep all his enemies away. And now they can see that it's not going to be like that. And it's shattering. That's why they run off into the shadows of the garden. Jesus is taken off to the high priest's palace. And there he's interrogated. The priests called it a trial. You couldn't really call it a trial. He was bullied. He was spat at. He was knocked about. But by the end of it all, he'd been sentenced to death. And Simon Peter is there when it all happens. He slipped into the courtyard of the palace. He can see and hear what's happening in the courtroom. I think Simon Peter was there because he was desperately hoping that even now something was going to change. Maybe Jesus would simply use his awesome power, the same power with which he walked on the water and stilled the storm. Maybe Jesus would just call down fire from heaven on these wicked people who are treating him in this way. Maybe Jesus would call for an army of angels to come and to slaughter the men who were shouting at him and lying at him. Peter's still clinging to a last desperate hope that this story is going to end in victory, not defeat. But as Peter watches Jesus being punched in the face, and as he sees Jesus being spat on, and as he hears the death sentence being pronounced, Peter knows it's not going to happen that way. He knows that all his dreams about glories and victories and triumphs are over. And when a servant girl says to Peter, "You're one of his followers, aren't you?" his answer is, "I never knew him." That's the story so far. Well, let's read on. We're going to read on from chapter 27, verse 11. And I'm aiming to read quite a long section this morning in parts. I'm going to try and keep my own comments brief. Really, I only want to draw out one point from the story as we read on, and you'll see it as it unfolds. Chapter 27, verse 11. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it's as you say," Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony they're bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message: "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I've suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" asked the governor. "Barabbas," they answered. "What shall I do then with Jesus who is called Christ?" Pilate asked. They all answered, "Crucify him." "Why, what crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him!" When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It is your responsibility." All the people answered, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." And then he released Barabbas to them. But he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. We'll pause there. The Jewish leaders didn't themselves have the authority to execute a prisoner. The Roman governor gave them a good deal of freedom, but that is one power that the Romans reserved for themselves. So first thing in the morning, the priests have to take Jesus to the governor. What they're going to do is they're going to try to stick a charge of treason on him. They've condemned Jesus to death for blasphemy. But blaspheming their Jewish God, well, that isn't a crime under Roman law. So these priests have got to find some other charge to stick on Jesus. He calls himself a king. King of the Jews. That's treason against the Roman emperor. That's the accusation they bring. And so the Roman governor puts the question to Jesus. "Well, are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answers him very carefully. In the NIV, his answer reads like this: "Yes, it is as you say." But that's not quite what Jesus actually spoke. There's no "yes" in the original Greek. If you translate it literally, his words are simply "you say." In other words, those are your words, not mine. What Jesus is really saying to Pilate is, "Yes, I am a king, but I would never choose to use that word. Because what you mean by a king is not what I mean by a king." And Pilate's baffled by that. Well, the priests keep pouring out their accusations against Jesus, and Jesus simply doesn't answer them. And Pilate becomes more and more baffled. And this is what he says to Jesus. He says, "Can't you hear the testimony?" In other words, the evidence they're bringing against you. "Haven't you got anything to say in your own defense?" Now remember, this is a court of law. Jesus' enemies have got to prove their case against him by bringing evidence, the testimony of witnesses. And that's what they're doing. The only thing is that the testimony they're bringing is a tissue of lies. They can't actually quote Jesus as saying, "I am the king," because he's never used those words. They can't actually prove that he's ever incited anybody to rebel against the Romans, because he never has done. He's told people to pay their taxes to Rome. He's told his disciples even to be willing to carry baggage for Roman soldiers, if that's what they ask for. The evidence that these religious leaders are bringing, their testimony, is simply false. But, and this is the thing I want you to see, nobody steps forward to refute their evidence. Not one of the disciples is there putting forward the truth. They're entitled to. This is a trial. Under Roman law, anybody can come forward and offer evidence. Well, why isn't Peter there? Why isn't John there? Why isn't Matthew there? After all, they know him. He used to work for the Roman authorities. Well, why isn't Simon the Zealot standing up? Before he met Jesus, he really did want to overthrow the Roman government. It would have been powerful testimony, wouldn't it, if Simon the Zealot had got to his feet and said, "Your Honour, I used to be a zealot. I used to be opposed to the government. Once I agitated to overthrow Caesar's rule, and it was when I came to Jesus that I gave that up. Jesus always told us to pray for our enemies. Well, I used to think of Caesar as my enemy. But since I've been a disciple of Jesus, I've been praying for Caesar." Couldn't one of the disciples have stood up there in the courtroom and told the story of the feeding of the 5,000? "Your Honour, the crowd back then tried to persuade Jesus to set himself up as a king. But he wouldn't have it. He sent them all away. He said he didn't want that. He didn't want any sort of earthly kingdom." But nobody said it. Not one of the disciples was there speaking up for Jesus. Not one of them was there to defend his honour. Not one of them was there making sure that the truth about Jesus was being heard in that courtroom amid all the lies. You know, going through Matthew's Gospel, we've concentrated on passages which talk about the disciples. Well, the disciples aren't here in this passage, are they? But that's the point. They're not here. They're missing. At the moment when you would expect them to be standing beside Jesus, they're not there. The only person who does speak up for Jesus is someone completely unexpected. Pilate's wife has had a dream about Jesus. And she sends Pilate a message saying, "Have nothing to do with this innocent man." Isn't it amazing? A pagan woman, a heathen woman, all she knows about Jesus is what she's learned in a dream. But she's prepared to act as witness in that case. She's prepared to testify that Jesus is innocent, while his disciples are nowhere to be seen. Well, it may have been because of her message that Pilate tried to find a way of setting Jesus free without upsetting the Jewish leaders too much. A crowd has gathered around the palace. Maybe the news has got out that Jesus has been arrested. And Pilate knows that there's a custom that one prisoner should be set free at Passover time. So he goes out and speaks to the crowd. He offers them a choice. "I'll either set free Barabbas or Jesus. Who would you prefer?" He assumes that the crowd will all choose Jesus. And then he'll be able to say to the priests, "Well, you can see the strength of public feeling. I mean, you know, I couldn't afford to upset the crowd, could I? I had to set Jesus free." But it doesn't work out that way. A crowd is a fickle thing. A crowd can easily be swayed by a few determined people. And the chief priests and the elders are determined. They're moving among the crowd. You know, you don't want Jesus. He's a troublemaker. I mean, remember the chaos he caused in the temple? I mean, and who does he think he is anyway? Carpenter from somewhere up north. And he rides into the city like a king. There's something phony about him. And the mood of the crowd begins to shift. And when Pilate asks, "Who do you want?" a voice shouts out from the crowd, "Barabbas!" And then lots more voices join in the shout, "We want Barabbas! We want Barabbas!" "But what about Jesus?" says Pilate. Someone starts up the chant, first quietly, and then as more people join in, the chant becomes louder and faster and more insistent. "Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him!" This crowd's getting out of control. They want blood. Where were the disciples? Again, it could have been different. If a few determined agitators could sway the crowd in one direction, couldn't 11 determined men have swayed the crowd in the other direction? Couldn't Simon Peter have been on his feet, reminding the crowd of the miracles which they themselves had seen in Jerusalem? But no, once again, the disciples aren't there. They're missing. They're conspicuous only by their absence. And so it continues. Let's read on. Verse 27. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers round him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spat on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. And after they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink, mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots, and sitting down they kept watch over him there. Above his head they placed the written charge against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you're the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. Well, let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, 'I'm the Son of God.'" In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs. And after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." Many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joses, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. It's grim reading, isn't it? First we read how Jesus was humiliated and tortured in the Roman barracks. Well, maybe we wouldn't expect to find the disciples there. But then, in verse 32, the soldiers take Jesus out of the barracks and they lead him through the streets. They've got to get him through the city with his cross to a place of execution outside the walls. And it's obvious he's not going to get there. He's near collapse. He's been beaten savagely. He must already have lost pints of blood. He's struggling on, but you can see he's stumbling at every step. I know what I want to happen. I want one of the disciples to step out of the crowd. I want one of them to go up to one of the soldiers and say, "Look, please let me carry his cross. Please let me help him. I can't bear to see him like this." Surely John will do that for Jesus, won't he? I mean, John is the disciple whom Jesus loved. John is Jesus' dearest friend. But no, there's not one of the disciples. Not one of them will step forward out of that crowd. Not one of them will offer to take the weight off Jesus now. The soldiers have to grab a stranger. A man from Cyrene who's just visiting Jerusalem. They have to order him to carry the cross. Isn't it strange? It takes a heathen woman to bear witness for Jesus in Pilate's court. It takes a visiting stranger to carry the cross for Jesus when he can't carry it any further, and the disciples aren't there. And so they arrive at Golgotha, the place of the skull. In my mind's eye, I see it as a little bare hill outside Jerusalem. And there they crucify Jesus. They lay the cross flat on the floor. They stretch Jesus out on it. They bang nails through his hands and his feet to pin him to those beams. And then they lift the cross up and it jolts into a socket that's there in the ground. It's probably been used for dozens of executions before. Jesus has already been stripped of his clothes. The soldiers share them out. And he's left hanging naked on that cross a few feet off the ground. As the sun gets higher in the sky, he's going to become agonizingly thirsty. The pain in every muscle, every joint is going to be excruciating. He's going to fight for breath. Every time he moves, his lacerated back is going to be rubbing against the rough wood of the cross. He's in agony, and the agony is going to get worse. And people laugh. That's the thing we've got here. The passers-by, they laugh at him. They insult him, verse 39. The chief priests and the teachers of the law and the elders, they pour out their scorn against him. That's in verse 41. Even the robbers who are executed on the same day, even they laugh and sneer at him. That's verse 44. And again we ask, where are the disciples? Again, I know what I want. I want to read, but the disciples stood and praised him. I want to read that one of the disciples, at least one, spoke out and said, this is unjust, he's innocent. But it's not there, is it? Not one of them speaks out. Not one of them is there to give a word of comfort or encouragement to Jesus, to say, be strong. Not one of them is there to say, I still love you. No, they're silent. The only person we read of here who does speak out for Jesus on this scene, who is it? Again, it's the stranger. It's the person who is the most unlikely person of all. It's the Roman centurion. It's a heathen man who's been in charge of the execution squad. As we come to the end of the crucifixion story, he speaks up for Jesus. Surely this man was the Son of God. He's risking ridicule, isn't he? From his men. You know, our Sergeant Major, he went bananas out there today. He started shouting out that the man we'd crucified was God's son. He spoke up. But not one of the disciples are there to speak up. We read that the women, at least, were there sitting at a distance. But in Matthew's account, no mention of any of the disciples speaking up for him. Amid all the agony of which we read, I want to read that one of the disciples stood forward to give him the little bit of help that was possible. Oh, it's not there. Again, it was a stranger who ran and got a sponge and filled it with wine vinegar to dampen Jesus' lips. He had just cried a desperate cry, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. And it was so incoherent that people couldn't make out what he was saying. He was speaking through cracked lips. He was speaking with a tongue that was dry as leather. That was why one of the bystanders rushed forward to try and at least moisten his lips. Couldn't one of the disciples have been there? Couldn't one of them have done that? But no. And then we read from verse 57 onwards. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea, named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Not heard of him before. He's not one of the 12. He's a new face on the scene. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. And Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. Jesus' corpse is hanging on the cross. What's going to happen to it? Normally the body of a criminal is just hurled out into the valley of Gehenna, and there it's eaten by the wild dogs. It's burned on the bonfires that burn there continually. Is that going to happen to the body of the Lord Jesus? Surely the 12 won't let that happen. Surely one of them will go to Pilate now and say, please, can we at least bury him in honour? But no, it's not what we read. Again, it's an outsider, someone who's never been one of the circle of the disciples to this point, who goes to Pilate and says, please, Can I bury him decently? Can I give him an honourable burial? Do you see what I mean when I say that as you read through these chapters, the most striking thing about the disciples is that they're not there. Not one of the 11 is there to give evidence on his behalf in the trial. Not one of them shouts out for him when the priests are demanding that Barabbas be set free. Not one of them tries to lift the weight of the cross from him when he's breaking under that weight. Not one of them will speak out for him when men are mocking him all around. Not one will offer a drink to him as he hangs there in desperate thirst. Not one of them has the courage to ask for his body so that they could honour him in death. They're not there. My time's almost gone. What do I learn from this passage? What do I learn from what we've read, what we've seen this morning? Four things this passage gives me. Firstly, it gives me such compelling evidence that Christianity is true. You know, there are people who, usually people who know very little about the Bible, who say, oh, all these stories in the Gospels, made up, just made up, they're fairy tales, made up years later. Would anybody have made up this these stories? When the 11 had gone on to become the great leaders of the church across the world, would they have made up stories of how the disciples had turned against Jesus, had neglected him, had failed and failed and failed and failed when he needed them most? Would anybody have made up stories like these? And given that these stories are true, when you see that these were the sort of men that the disciples were, then you're left saying, how? How could men like these, how could men who had collapsed so totally, how could these men ever have become the power that they did become, apart from the resurrection of the Lord Jesus from the dead? When you see the total failure of the disciples, how totally they've run away from Jesus, there's no way of accounting for the courage and the zeal and the passion with which they were to preach the gospel across the world, apart from the fact that Jesus came back from the dead to put these broken men back together again and to fill them with his own spirit. This passage gives me such compelling evidence that Christianity is true. And then secondly, this passage gives me such a shocking reminder of the depths of failure and sin to which real believers can fall. These men were believers. These men were men who had a living faith in Christ. These men were men whose hearts had been set aflame with love for Christ. And yet, they could collapse into this awful dereliction of duty. They could collapse into a frame of mind in which they could watch Jesus humiliated, tortured, laughed at, and not lift one finger for him. You know, if we didn't have the last chapter of Matthew's Gospel, the account of the resurrection, if we didn't have the book of Acts, if we didn't have the story of all that was to follow, we would point to these men and say, these men couldn't have been real believers, could they? Real believers couldn't have acted as they did. Real believers couldn't have stood by and let Jesus be condemned without saying one word for him. Real believers couldn't have acted like that, could they? Real believers did. The depths to which believers can descend. It's a fearful thing. Thirdly, I want to say that this passage gives me such a startling proof of the dangers of muddled theology. Why did these men collapse so totally? Well, because their theology was so muddled. We've said it. They had their ideas of what Jesus was going to do, of how Jesus was going to gain his kingdom. They had their ideas, and their ideas didn't include a cross. Their ideas didn't include a paying for sin by Jesus' own sacrifice. They had a true theology. Their theology encompassed the triumphs of Jesus, the kingship of Jesus, the victories of Jesus. They'd seen all those things in the Old Testament, and they heard those things from the lips of Jesus. But their theology had left out so much. Their theology was all out of balance. And that's why when Jesus was arrested, all their expectations are shattered and they collapse so totally. It is possible for a person to be a real believer but have a very muddled theology. But a believer with a muddled theology, a believer whose thinking is not clear, a believer who hasn't understood the whole of the gospel as it's taught in the whole of the Bible, that believer is so vulnerable when things go wrong. A believer is so vulnerable when things happen in their life in a way that they don't expect. Some people think that when we preach doctrine, when we preach theology, it's all academic. It was no academic matter for these men, was it? It was because they hadn't understood the clear picture that they fell so catastrophically. And then fourthly, this passage gives me such a sad rebuke to my own failure to stand up for Jesus. I wonder what the disciples felt. I think they were probably watching from a distance through many of these events. What must they have felt when they hear that it's Pilate's wife who came forward to do what they didn't have the courage to do? How must they have felt when they saw Simon of Cyrene shouldering the cross that they didn't have the love that he would take to shoulder it? How must they have felt when they heard a Roman centurion declare the truth about Jesus when they had been silent? How must they have felt when they saw this unknown bystander do what he could for Jesus, at least give him a drink, when they hadn't lifted a finger for Jesus? How must they have felt when they saw, who's this man? Joseph of Arimathea, tenderly bearing the body of Jesus, when if it had been left to them, his body would have been thrown to the dogs. How must they have felt? What a rebuke to them. What a rebuke to me when I think of all the times when I could have stood up for Jesus and didn't. All those times when others mocked him and I let it carry on. All those times when I could have served the Lord Jesus. You know, these disciples, Jesus wonderfully restores them. Jesus wonderfully forgives them. Jesus gives them many, many more opportunities in the years ahead to serve him. But surely through all eternity, there will still be the grief. I didn't when I could have done. You know, in the world to come, in all the unfoldings of the eternal ages, you will never again have the chance to speak up for a despised Jesus. It's now, here in this world, you must speak up for a despised Jesus. It's here in this world that you must stand with a crucified Jesus. It's here in this world that you must serve him when men are laughing at him. You won't have that opportunity again when this world is past. You'll have the opportunity to praise and enthrone Jesus. But it's here in this world that you must serve the Jesus of Calvary. Well, may God give us grace to do just that.